Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. You might be wondering, why is this episode dropping early? Well, that is because we are officially moving to publishing once a week. Why? Because we have a lot of really, really great guests coming up. Can't have them wait any longer, so I'm really excited to start publishing more regularly and just keep on bringing to you guys a really great variety of different scholars on different topics. And we're starting off really strong here with Dr. Neil Ferguson, who really needs no introduction, though I'm going to introduce him anyway. And he's going to be finally finishing up our series on freedom of speech. Dr. Ferguson is the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and a Senior Faculty Fellow of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. He's the author of a full 16 books, and a good smattering of them do come up in this conversation. Most recently, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Amid his many other projects, he's also one of the founders of the University of Austin, which is an experimental new university in Austin, Texas, with a really good focus on free speech. So that's going to be a pretty major piece of this conversation. So, with no further ado, the esteemed Neil Ferguson. Dr. Ferguson, welcome to the show. We're so grateful to have you on.
It's great to be on, Annika. Please call me Neil.
So, to kick us off, I said that we were going to have this conversation about education. You just wrote a book about Doom, and you just gave a lecture, which is on our website, which I had the pleasure of being the audience for, about the death, or maybe impending death, we don't know, of liberal democracy. And it seems to me that historically you could probably make an argument that these are related. So I'm wondering if you could kick us off by talking a little bit about how you see kind of the state of education and academia as playing into the potential for either the death of democracy or doom in some way of our country.
Well, Annika, those are two quite large questions. Let me start with the politics of catastrophe.
Yeah.
The book Doom was inspired by the pandemic, but it's not a book about the pandemic. It's a book about disasters in history of all shapes and sizes. And a key argument of the book is that there's a false dichotomy between natural and man-made disasters. In reality, just about every disaster, whatever its origins, causes excess mortality as a consequence of the way it's mismanaged. And that's true of volcanic eruptions. It's true of pandemics. It's true of everything. And a key point that the book makes is that while one might worry about a variety of possible disasters, and people love to worry about climate change these days, the experience of the 20th century is that few things are remotely as disastrous as totalitarian governments, because governments such as those of Stalin, Hitler, and Mao killed tens of millions of people prematurely, ending the lives of just an unfathomably large number of people, often cruelly and violently. And so a very major preoccupation of mine is that we should try our best to avoid giving the opportunity once again to totalitarian regimes to commit mass murder. So if one looks at the world today, it is very clear that there is something of an alliance forming between totalitarian regimes of various stamps, of which the most powerful by far is the regime of the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Republic of China. That poses a major strategic threat to the United States. And if you think of it as being allied to Imperial Russia, which is really what Putin is running, and theocratic Iran, and North Korea, that's quite an axis of ill will that yep. we're up against. In order to prevent that axis of ill will causing catastrophic events in the 21st century, we really need to be ready to fight and win a second Cold War.
Hmm.
I hope we won't have to fight and win World War III, but Cold War II is already underway. If we allow our educational institutions to become so corrupted that they no longer instill a love of liberty, but in fact achieve the opposite, instill a contempt for the United States, then we shouldn't be too surprised if we lose Cold War II. So that's the connection from catastrophe of the sort that I can very easily imagine happening, and the decay of our educational institutions, which I think means that the American elite is much less well prepared for a Cold War than its predecessor back in the 1950s.
So I promise to be more or less chronological here, but with the Cold War connection, I can't resist. I mean, I think Americans think of the Cold War as being kind of an economic conflict in a lot of ways. And it's sort of frightening because a lot of the very same ideologies that we were fighting against in the Cold War are very much enjoying a second life right now. I mean, from your perspective, is the ideological portion of that, how is that being reincarnated in the present Cold War?
People sometimes make the mistake of thinking that the rivalry between the United States and the People's Republic of China is not ideological.
Yeah.
And I'm often told, no, because the Soviet Union was very ideological, but the People's Republic of China is not. And it's really, in fact, a capitalist system. Mm. And therefore, the competition is really just an economic or technological one. This is quite wrong. In truth, one of the features of Xi Jinping's rule is that he has revived Marxism-Leninism as an integral part of the regime's ideology. It's bound up with other things in so-called Xi Jinping thought. But Xi Jinping thought is explicitly hostile to democracy, to the rule of law, to notions of self-determination. And that's why once Xi Jinping had established his dominance in Chinese politics, there was an all-out purge of Western ideas at Chinese universities. And I observed how this worked because I was a visiting professor at Tsinghua in Beijing for 5 years. Mm. And over that five-year period, as he consolidated his grip on power, the culture, the atmosphere at the university changed decisively from a relatively open one at the beginning to one in which there was censorship and self-censorship all around. So I think one needs to recognize that in truth, the CCP has reverted to its ideological roots, that Xi Jinping sees himself in some ways as Mao's successor, and nostalgia for Mao, or Mao-stalgia, is something that I remember writing about and broadcasting about more than 10 years ago. And so it's not just some straightforward competition to see whose AI is better. It is ideological, and I think people in the West deceive themselves about that because they don't really pay attention to what the Chinese leaders say to their own people, as opposed to what they say when they turn up at Davos.
Right.
So you actually have to look, as, say, Rush Doshi's book does, at what the Chinese say to one another, what the CCP says to its members, to understand just how ideological the regime now is. I have not ever said that Cold War II is a clone of Cold War
I. Right.
Because the analogy is with World War II and World War I, and they weren't the same. But they're similar enough for it to make sense to have that nomenclature and to number them. And I think Cold War II will be enough like Cold War I for it to make sense to use that language and to recognize that we had an interwar period which ran from about 1991 when the Soviet Union fell apart to somewhere around, I think, 2017 or 2018 when it began to be clear that a new Cold War was beginning and China was taking the place of the Soviet Union. So I think that's the right way to think about our time. And it struck me very forcibly when I asked Henry Kissinger about that back in 2019, actually at a conference in Beijing. And I interviewed him in front of a fairly large audience, and I asked him, And are we in a new Cold War? And he replied memorably, we're in the foothills of a Cold War. Mm. And my feeling was, well, if Henry Kissinger thinks we're in the foothills of a Cold War, then we probably are. People have, a slightly patchy memory of the first Cold War, especially if they've never really studied it. And they forget that over four decades or so, the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union was ideological, but it was also technological. It was also geopolitical. At some level, it was a fairly classic contest between two rival empires. And it was often a hot war, that it manifested itself in multiple hot wars, whether in Korea or Vietnam, in which the superpowers were either directly or indirectly involved. The United States and Soviet Union didn't go head to head, except very nearly in the case of Cuba in 62, but they fought a lot of proxy wars. And that's important to bear in mind because we have already got that kind of a war going on now in Ukraine. And that's very clearly a war that needs to be understood in a Cold War context, because Ukraine would not be still in the war without the US and European support. And Russia wouldn't still be in the war without Chinese support. So I think you should think of it as a bit like the Korean War that broke out in 1950, the first hot war of Cold War II.
I'm very interested, I mean, when you talk about China purging Western ideas, I mean, at the risk of stating something really, really obvious, Marx is a Westerner. And the Chinese, when the Cultural Revolution happened, purged a lot of their own Eastern culture. So it seems to me like, I mean, at a minimum, they're being selective about which Western things they want to keep and which things they want to discourage. In your kind of experience, what are some of the things about the West that they think are dangerous and that they don't want? And what are some of the things that they're keeping and emphasizing?
Well, Xi Jinping's quite explicit about that.
Right.
Democracy, multi-party democracy is out. The Chinese claim that they have democracy because they have these elections within the CCP at the local level, but it's a sort of charade because it's a one-party system. Rule of law. A rule of law is a very, very dangerous concept because it might imply that the party, that everybody, including Xi Jinping, were under the law. But that's not the case. What China has is rule by law, and the party is effectively above that. So those are two key ideas. The Chinese are also very wary of ideas of self-determination, color revolutions. After all, they're extremely hostile to minority populations within their own empire, particularly the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. So there are a bunch of very classic Western notions that are now clearly anathema in China. And I think the things that they want are to have the benefits of a market economy without its foundations in representative government and the protection of property rights. You can't really have a free market if property rights are contingent on a party that's above the law. So that's why the Chinese economy is falling apart, which it gradually is, because they ran the following experiment. This is something I wrote about in a book called Civilization that was published more than a decade ago. And in Civilization, I argued the reason for Western ascendancy after about 1500 or 1600 is that certain ideas evolve in the West that really didn't exist anywhere else.
Right.
And there were six so-called, I called them killer applications, because I thought it might engage the interest of my students. So the killer apps of Western civilization were six. The first one was just the notion that competition was legitimate. In economic and in political life, it was okay to have competition and multiple power centers. The second idea was just a scientific revolution as a way of engaging with nature, and that too originated in the West before it really took root anywhere else. And then there were other things: the rule of law based on private property rights. The idea of modern medicine, which is really quite a late development, comes quite a way after the scientific revolution. And then two other things, the work ethic and the consumer society. And you can't really have an industrial revolution, which happened in the West first, without those things. So the experiment in China was to see if you could have some but not all of the six. You could get the scientific revolution, You could have a work ethic, and they do have a work ethic, no question. And you could have a consumer society, but you were going to dispense with competition. And you were going to dispense with the rule of law based on private property rights. And that's what the experiment consists of. And it turns out, and I didn't know at the time I wrote the book what the result would be, but my hypothesis was this won't work. This can't be sustainable, because if you try to have the benefits of the Western system, but you're kind of downloading not the whole operating system, but just part of it, it won't work, and it isn't working. And you can see that it's not working by the demographics, the collapsing population, fertility far beyond below the replacement rate, a system of central control which has created a huge nightmare of debt and deflation in the real estate sector, and the falling stock market, which they're desperately trying to do something about, is telling you that investors around the world are seeing that it's not a sustainable system. So my question's kind of been answered. You can't have, you can't select your killer apps and just have an a la carte approach. Without all six, it's not stable.
And I'm interested, I mean, some of the things that you listed that China's kind of dispensing with, for instance, rule of law, strike me as some of the things that we also struggle with domestically within academia. So I think it's kind of a good transition. Yes. And one of the things that I love about having a historian here is we have the privilege of actually starting more or less at the beginning. And I know the world wars aren't exactly the beginning, but I think it's sort of a good place to kind of begin dissecting what happened, because it's such a turning point in Western intellectual history. I mean, even kind of coming from more of a classics background, you do encounter things like commentaries that were written before World War II or sometimes even before World War I, and the difference in tone and the attitude even towards something that seems totally unrelated is just so striking. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about kind of the transition that happened with the world wars, what changed before and after in our academic culture?
Well, it's a very difficult question that you've posed, because there wasn't a single monolithic academic culture in the 19th century. That there were a whole variety of different institutional models. What went on in England was very different from what went on in Scotland, which was different from what went on in Germany, which was different from what went on in France, which was different from what went on in the United States. And it's extraordinary what a patchwork you come across when you look at the history of higher education in the 19th century. By the end of the 19th century, the German universities had emerged as the leaders.
Yeah.
And it was generally acknowledged, even at Oxford and Cambridge, that the great German universities were setting the pace in natural sciences, in physics, particularly in mathematics, but also in classical scholarship, in history. And there was a kind of sense in the English-speaking world that the Germans had professionalized academic work, and their system with doctorates, often two doctorates, habilitation, all of this was admirable and should be to some extent copied. And so there was a very interesting divergence at around that time, which meant that the German universities were dominant in scientific research, and that continued even despite the interruption of World War I into the 1920s. I think the First World War had a transformative effect in most disciplines. You can see that in a book like Stuart Hughes's Consciousness and Society. The evolution of sociology or psychology, just to take two examples, would have been very different without the 4.25 years of industrialized, mechanized slaughter. What's fascinating to me, though, is what happened to the German universities. Because while the British and American universities were scrambling to catch up with the Germans, and particularly in the United States, to import things from Germany, the German universities themselves entered a strange crisis. And what was the nature of that crisis? I think it was that they became politicized. And this is something Max Weber noticed happening. during and immediately after the war, and he wrote a very scathing lecture on the subject, which was the lecture Science as a Vocation. Well, there were two. There was Politics as a Vocation and Science as a Vocation. And in those two lectures, Weber argued that there should be a clear separation between politics and scholarship, but there no longer was in Germany. Now, what he had in mind was the fact that more and more German professors had become explicitly identified with German nationalism. And in the wake of Germany's defeat in 1918, had been even more politically radicalized. So the German universities moved to the right.
Right.
They embraced National Socialism before the German population as a whole. German academics were amongst the earliest adopters of National Socialism. And one can see in the 1920s this process antedating Hitler's coming to power in 1933 by at least a decade. Weber was right about this. It's absolutely clear that universities should not be politicized and that there must be a separation of politics and scholarship. And that led the German universities down the path to hell because they were, to a stunning extent, enablers of the Third Reich. The ideology that Hitler sets out in Mein Kampf is quite incoherent. He was a burglar of other men's ideas and not a particularly sophisticated burglar. And so, for example, the ideas of race, which were imported from the United States, of the dangers of miscegenation, all of that is a sort of jumble in Mein Kampf. How do you turn that jumble of ideas into the ideology and legislation and practice of a racial empire? The answer is that you need a lot of academics to write down the textbooks that define what is a Jew, the laws that codify how racial discrimination should be carried out, and then ultimately even the doctoral dissertations that explain how you should dispose of the gold fillings of those people you have gassed and incinerated. And German academia supplied all of that. It supplied all, if you like, the software that was necessary for Hitler's garbled ideology to become the basis of one of the world's most hideous empires. There's a tremendously important warning in that story for universities in every nation. And that warning is, if you allow universities to become politicized, if you think it's okay for professors to be activists, do not be surprised if bad things follow, because they've immediately violated Weber's rule. Weber said, you must leave your politics at the entrance to the lecture hall. My position has always been, you should not really be able to tell if I'm delivering a course of lectures on history what my politics might actually be. Once that's disregarded and professors use the lectern to engage in political activism, you're already on the path that the German universities went down, even if you say to yourself, oh, but they were right wing and we're left wing and that's okay, and that makes it okay. No, it doesn't make it okay. And you may well surprise yourself by how quickly you arrive at anti-Semitism. See events of October the 7th, 2023, and subsequently on the major US campuses.
One of the things that really strikes me about your answer is kind of the emphasis on how much power academics actually have, because that's something that I think certainly the American right has struggled with for a while, understanding how this ecosystem could work such that what people do locked away in some ivory tower somewhere actually does matter and can be important and necessary for either in a good or a bad way for political projects. So can you talk a little bit about that ecosystem? I mean, is it there's some people who take the approach of we need to therefore neutralize the universities somehow, just kind of toss them out the door? Some people who take the approach of more build something alternate, some people who take the approach of work from within. How do you think about how to deal with the power that academics have that you've described?
Well, I arrived at this studio where we're sitting by walking across the Princeton campus. And I was reminded once again of what a strange thing the American university has become. A cloistered, a community cut off really from the real world, physically as well as institutionally, with an opportunity to shape the minds of thousands of young people over periods of 4 years or longer, if they do more than an undergraduate degree. And these are powerful institutions. That the image of an ivory tower is misleading, because really they're much more like camps, where for an extended period of quite pleasant internment, young people have their minds substantially altered. We know that they're altered because we can measure the change in people's attitudes before they go to university and after. And in the United States, universities are really quite effective at shifting young people to the left on a range of issues. And surveys by Heterodox Academy, for example, or by FIRE, show that people are aware that they're having their attitudes changed when they go to university. And I think it's indeed a powerful position that a professor occupies, even if it's only for a couple of hours a week. You are in a position of authority. Not only do the students have to listen to you, but they must be aware that when they write their papers, midterms and finals, the professor will decide on the grade. And it's readily acknowledged by students that if you want to get that cherished A, you mustn't dissent too far from the professorial view. So this is a very unhealthy state of affairs, but it's the reality of the American university. The students watch what they say. We know that about 59 or 60% of students self-censor in class, and they do it not just to avoid saying things that the professor might be offended by, but more to avoid saying things that their classmates might be offended by. So the culture has become an extraordinarily suffocating one. This happened quite quickly. It was not like that when I first taught in the United States. But in the last 10 years, we've gone from free exchanges in classrooms to walking on eggshells and self-censoring. What does one do about this? That is the big question. Mm. It can't be good for a free society to have less free speech at its universities than anywhere else. It can't be good for a free society to have its academic elites educated at institutions with a culture of self-censorship and indeed indoctrination. But I have yet to hear a plausible account of how you transform the established universities back to what they were, which I think they were 20 years ago, places where a fairly free exchange of ideas was possible, even if the majority of faculty leant to the left. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you change Harvard back to the way it was when so many of the tenured professors seem entirely committed to a politics of progressivism, and when the institution itself has mandated the pursuit of quote-unquote diversity, equity, and inclusion as objectives. I just don't know how you can fix that, because once you've hired a bunch of people and given them tenure who don't accept Weber's distinction between politics and scholarship, it's very hard to undo that. And that's why I've been persuaded for the last 3 years that we need new universities. We need to start over, because I don't think you can fix the established ones, much as I, you know, loved them once. I mean, I did love the established universities. I was in love with Harvard for a while and thought I would spend my career there. But it came to me gradually over 12 years that there was something rotten in the state of Harvard and Yale, and I'm afraid Princeton, and all the universities. It began to become clear to me that they all had very similar problems that would be extremely hard to fix. So no, I think the only solution under the circumstances is to start over and build some new institutions, and hope that if a new institution such as the University of Austin can model academic freedom and can model meritocracy, it will start to attract the kind of students and the kind of professors that believe in those things and crave those things. And as soon as we can do that, then I think the entire landscape changes, because suddenly there'll be an alternative model. And I think that alternative model will be very quickly a powerful magnet for talent. And once you take talent and give it freedom, then the innovation soon follows.
I mean, I was kind of struck by how you described how quickly things went downhill. And it seems to me that the biggest challenge in starting a new project is pinpointing exactly what went wrong so that the same sort of rapid deterioration doesn't occur again. Can you, I guess, kind of in your analysis, as you've been involved with University of Austin, what is kind of the piece of the puzzle that's been missing for these other universities that's caused them to go so deeply downhill? And I mean, the rapidity kind of frightens me a little bit. Do you think that is because everything had sort of been in place for a while and then someone, you know, knocked over the first domino or pulled out the Jenga piece, so to speak? Or is it something that would actually be much more difficult to prevent?
Well, I've thought a lot about that, and I've tried to think about it as an historian. If you look at the history of US universities, there's quite a variance in institutional design. Some are quite decentralized, Harvard, and some are quite centralized, Duke. Some had their origins in one religious tradition and some in another. And yet, despite their very different points of origin, they all seem to have arrived at a somewhat similar place. The University of Chicago is a relatively recent foundation dating back to the 1890s. It prides itself on its Chicago principles of academic freedom. If you look at the survey data, there's just as much self-censorship, and students are just as ready to engage in the disruption of events where ideas they disapprove of are aired as they are at Princeton. And so what's the conclusion? The conclusion I came to was that all the universities, despite their disparate points of origin, had the same institutional defect. And that institutional defect was that there was no method of enforcement, no matter how fine the policy on academic freedom might be. And it's actually a simple problem of institutional design that any American should get immediately. Every university has an executive branch, and that is the president and the provost and the bureaucracy. And it has a legislative branch, although it's not clear if that's the trustees or the tenured faculty. And at some universities, I could mention, the tenured faculty think that they're the legislative branch, which they really shouldn't be, because they're just the best paid employees. But there's at least an idea of a legislative branch. But there's no judicial branch. No university has a judicial branch. And so there's no way of enforcing the Chicago principles if you think they're being violated. You're really at the mercy of the executive branch, the bureaucracy in effect, to determine whether or not you have a case. And so if the executive branch is taken over by people entirely committed to an activist project, there's no safeguard. There's no way of holding them to account. There's no way, and I know this from firsthand experience, of saying, hang on, I think this is being conducted in a way that is at odds with the university's policy. Who do you say that to? And you discover at the moment of crisis that there is no judicial branch. And there is no due process either, because if there's no judicial branch, there isn't actually a rule of law on university campuses. There is a purely bureaucratic process where the equivalent of the Committee of Public Safety decides whether you are, in fact, an enemy of the revolution, an enemy of the people or not. And so the solution, I think, is an institutional one, and that is you have to have an explicit written constitution which defines the rights and responsibilities of the members of the university, and then you have to have a judicial branch which has to be capable of having its judgments upheld. So that's going to be the big difference between the University of Austin and other universities. There will be a way of taking action if you think your rights have been violated, whether it's by the president or by a professor. it doesn't matter. You should have that ability. And if you are accused of some wrong, of some transgression, there should be due process, which there isn't on university campuses today. If you're accused by some elements of the bureaucracy of having committed transgression, as a number of friends of mine have discovered, you are in deep trouble because you don't have any of the rights you would have if you were accused in a criminal or civil case outside the university campus. So having due process is really crucial. And that, I think, means that we have a better institutional design at the University of Austin. Now, that's not enough. And I'm not so dogmatic and institutionalist to think that it's enough to have a good constitution and enough to have the procedures set down in writing. The spirit of the university will have to be a spirit of freedom, and it will need to be maintained as such by all concerned. And that's the thing that's perhaps hardest of all, that the question that is often put to me is, well, how do you stop the University of Austin going the way of all the other universities? And the answer in a kind of boring way is, well, you just have to make sure that every appointment is very carefully weighed, and you can't appoint people who are fundamentally inimical to that spirit, that they should not really be considered for appointments if they aren't committed to those ideals of academic freedom and meritocracy. There are plenty of places for people who are not committed to those ideals to have successful academic careers, but Austin won't be one of them.
Yeah, I mean, from my kind of experience on the student end at Stanford, I couldn't agree more. And I think a lot of it has to do with transparency, where the university judicial system, such as it exists, at least kind of the experience of me and some of my friends, a lot of the point was to avoid scandal, to avoid things hitting the press, which, as we've learned from recent events, is kind of wise on their part from a self-preservation standpoint, because often when things do hit the press, things blow up.
Well, I mean, what's odd about the culture you describe is how very quickly these institutions began to behave like authoritarian regimes. And to me, it's a fascinating thing. I would never have predicted this when I was your age. I was a happy and rather irksome graduate student. I enjoyed arguments and I enjoyed being a contrarian. And if you had told me back in the mid-1980s that the least free speech in America would be on university campuses, I'd have been incredulous. And when I realized what was going on around me at Harvard and Stanford, it was uncanny because it reminded me of something that I knew very well. And that was the behavior of people in communist regimes. I knew that well from being in East Germany and catching the tail end of the Soviet Union. Now, in those regimes, nobody tells the truth. In those regimes, nobody is sure who is going to inform on whom. In those regimes, freedom of the press is, of course, out of the question. In those regimes, it's routine to write letters of denunciation to the authorities. In those regimes, it's common for people to be cancelled, to disappear, even to be airbrushed out of the photographs. And so to my amazement, I realized that people around me were behaving exactly as if they were in the German Democratic Republic of the early 1980s, despite the fact that they lived in a clearly free society. Now, this is the thing that was really new to me. When I was a graduate student, I used to spend time with Norman Stone, a great historian of Central and Eastern Europe. And I think Norman had me believing that those pathologies, those odious kinds of behavior, only went on when an undemocratic dictatorial regime facilitated them. The idea that people would choose in a free society to behave that way, that students would write anonymous or secret letters of denunciation about their colleagues or about their professors, that they would do that in a free society, I never saw that coming. I never thought that people would choose to behave that way. And this totalitarianism light, the sort of voluntary campus totalitarianism, has been one of the great surprises of my life. I really didn't see that coming. And I never cease to marvel at the kind of ignorance of history that must be necessary for people to behave that way and not feel shame.
Mm.
How does one not feel shame as one writes the letter of denunciation? I don't know. To me, it would just be a morally disgusting thing to do. I'd immediately think of, oh, I don't know, darkness at noon. I'd immediately think of Stalin's Soviet Union. But the impulse to behave that way must be much stronger than I had understood, that it could be possible in a free society.
I mean, it makes me think again of the discussion we were just having about the world wars and your excellent piece, The Treason of the Intellectuals, because it seems like a lot of this kind of behavior is done pretty much explicitly in the name of not repeating the mistakes of World War II. And yet, as you observe, in a strange way, in the attempt not to do that, people have started to emulate a lot of the activity. I mean, how do you... Can you help me make sense of how both of those things could be true? Are people just sort of not reading the history correctly? But why is it that people are so quick to bring in the example of World War II and yet don't really understand what happened very well?
I'm not sure that we're teaching it or have taught it very successfully.
Hmm.
In that, I don't think there are that many good courses that convey to students what life in an unfree society was like.
Mm.
Now, I think if you look at what is taught in history departments in the United States today, you would find a shortage of courses that confronted people with the realities of life under Stalin, life under Hitler, life under Mao.
Mm.
But you'd find a plethora of courses of the, Fanon Said variety on settler colonialism and the wickedness of empire. So the shift in the content of historical teaching is part of what's going on here.
Mm.
And it's the only way I can make sense of the phenomenon you describe, where people claim to be acting to avert some authoritarian outcome and yet behave in entirely authoritarian ways. This disconnect's only possible if you haven't understood how Hitler came to power, if you haven't understood how Stalin ruled the Soviet Union, if you haven't understood what the Cultural Revolution really signified. So I think, as an historian of the 20th century, I think we historians of that period did a bad job of conveying the key lessons of 20th century history. And we allowed the initiative to be taken by a school of historiography of which I have the lowest opinion. And that school of historiography essentially engages in the systematic condescension towards the people of the past. This is the school that looks at the behavior of Europeans around the world in the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries and says how deplorable these people were. Racists, they were sexists, they were in every way reprehensible. Now, this is to judge the past by the yardsticks of our time, which is the very opposite of what one should do. The real objective of historical scholarship is an understanding of the past's mode of thinking, which is very different from our own. One has to make the mental leap to the mental world of the 18th or 19th century and to set out on that journey, not with the view to judging and disparaging, but with a view to understanding. So at some point, I think history failed.
Mm.
And it's measurable. I remember sitting down some years ago now, and just looking at the content of courses that were offered at Harvard and Stanford, and comparing what was in the course book in the 1960s, the range of subjects that were available to students then, and comparing those books with today's, and there was just this huge, there were all these huge omissions, there were things just missing. But I think that can only be part of the story, and I don't want to give too much importance to history departments. There must be some broader collective failure to process the history of the 20th century and draw the right conclusions from it. And I think that must lie beyond the confines of the university and must lie in the realm of popular culture. At some point, we stopped understanding, maybe because we talked about it too much and read about it too little, what really happened in the period of particularly the 1930s and 1940s.
And so I think, I mean, from a pedagogy perspective, I found it very interesting when I looked at UATX's website. The undergraduate course of study that you've put forth is extremely structured, very much the opposite of what I experienced at Stanford, for example, which was basically as a la carte as physically possible. Yeah. They're like afraid of telling you what to do. I do think, I mean, there's probably an argument for having a more kind of student-driven type of curriculum, but it, I don't know. In my opinion, definitely fear of telling people what to do is a part of it, at least for the university that I attended. I don't know if that's true broadly. And so I guess from your standpoint, looking at those failures as a historian, why does UATX have such a structured kind of curriculum put forward? How do you think history education can improve and should be done differently for undergraduates?
Well, I went through a fairly structured undergraduate education at Oxford. The three-year program didn't give you choice, really, much choice until the last year or so when you had to select further and special subjects. And otherwise, it was a sort of boot camp of English and European history. Now, that was too narrow in many respects, but it meant that there was a certain common body of things we studied. And I think my sense is that as we design the curriculum for the University of Austin, we want to achieve two things. One is to be interdisciplinary and not to allow departmental silos to form. Instead of having departments, we have centers. The center I'm going to be most involved with is a center for economics, politics, and history. And our goal there is to give people a sense, a grounding in those disciplines with a little bit of a law thrown in too. If one's trying to give a young person, perhaps also an old person, I don't see why university should be confined to the young, a sense of what the foundations are, then there are certain things that I think it's important to read. There is a kind of hierarchy of reading priorities. There are crucial works, for example, I'll just give one example of political philosophy, which I think one is poorly educated if one hasn't read. And whether it's Plato or Machiavelli or Tocqueville, there is clearly going to be a role for what is sometimes called the great books approach. I was required to read Tocqueville in my first year at Oxford, and it was an absolutely seminal experience to read L'Ancien Régime in the original, which tested my schoolboy French, and to learn Tocqueville's great insights about what had happened in revolutionary France. When you read that book in conjunction with Democracy in America, you have a fantastic idea of why certain democratic projects failed, like France's after the revolution, and certain democratic projects succeeded, like that of the United States. So I think that we should be unabashed about getting students to do those required essential readings and to ensure that there is, particularly by the end of year two, a really solid foundation in economics, politics, history, and law. And the same thing needs to go on as the undergraduates navigate mathematics, as they navigate the STEM subjects more broadly. I think undergraduate programs in universities in the United States have become smorgasbords, and they're gamed. You game the system by taking the papers that you know will get A's, even if you don't particularly respect the content. None of that's going to be possible. And one way of thinking about this is by analogy with military training. If one organized the training of U.S. Special Forces in the same way as we organize the training of our academic elite, it would be absurd. Imagine if you made shooting a rifle optional as opposed to a required curriculum. I think the military has retained the ideal of elitism when it's been cast aside in the academic world. And at the University of Austin, I've said it before and I'll say it again, we want the Navy SEALs of the mind. We want the we want the Green Berets of the academy. And it will be hard. The University of Austin will be harder work than Princeton or Harvard or Yale undergrad programs. I guarantee that. And it will be hard because there will be no shortcuts. There will be no soft options. You won't be able to get around reading, oh, I don't know, War and Peace. I think everyone should read War and Peace. Yes, it's long. get over it. Reading fast is a skill. Acquire it.
And so I want to be respectful of your time, but I want to end asking a little bit about the future, and especially because I think you and I might have had kind of a shared experience coming from sort of a more stodgy East Coast history oriented background, moving west, and I at least was quite, it was definitely a culture shock, the extreme tech optimism that you experienced when you first moved to Silicon Valley. And some of it's, I mean, maybe the optimism part isn't coming to fruition, but a lot of kind of their predictions about the future are coming to fruition right now with ChatGPT and the really rapid progression of AI. And so I kind of wonder, I mean, from a historian's standpoint, is that kind of extreme optimism about technology and about the future, is it warranted? And I mean, tech people, in my experience, do not care at all about history. I once made a reference to the Aeneid to one of my friends who works at Google, and he asked me if it was a TV show. What about history do they need to know? Why would it be important for them?
Aeneid would make quite a good TV show.
I know. I'm waiting.
Get me Netflix. The culture that I encountered when I moved from Harvard to Stanford in 2016 was amazing because of its unbridled optimism.
Yeah.
The world is going to be connected and everything will be awesome. That was the message.
Yep.
And I wrote a book about this called The Square and the Tower, in which I tried to argue that while there were certainly going to be benefits to connecting the world on the internet, there would be costs, just as there were costs to the great breakthrough that the printing press brought to Europe in the late 15th century. And the techno-optimists were missing the shadow side of all technological change. It's like nuclear fission, which was very awesome, but it's nevertheless a striking feature of nuclear fission as a technology that we've built way more nuclear weapons than nuclear reactors in the last 70 years. So I start from the position, which I think is historically quite well founded, that most technological innovations will have benefits and they will have costs. And on the whole, the benefits have exceeded the costs, which is why we've had sustained economic growth since the late 18th century, and this is a good thing. We mustn't be blind to the shadow side. This is especially true of artificial intelligence, something which has happened more slowly than people realize, because there was discussion of AI back in Alan Turing's day. And it's taken until very recently indeed for there to be the compute power to make it possible to pass the Turing test in the way that ChatGPT does. I think the downsides of artificial intelligence, which are quite well described by Mustafa Suleiman in his book, The Coming Wave, are quite troubling. And we don't see much sign that there will be a regulatory framework to protect us from those. I mean, just to give a single example, it is extremely clear that breakthroughs in biological weapons will be possible with large language models that weren't hitherto possible. And this is a deeply worrying thing. So I have spent the last, 7 years trying to persuade people in and around Stanford in Silicon Valley that they need to learn from history and that nobody involved in artificial intelligence should be ignorant of, let's say, the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, AI will have applications, does have applications in the defense sector, and it's not analogous perfectly with atomic weapons, but it's near enough for you to want to know the dilemmas of Robert Oppenheimer, just to give you one example. So I actually think it's a scandal that people graduate from Stanford and go off to work for Google or Microsoft knowing nothing, nothing really about history.
Yeah.
And I remember trying to persuade Bill Gates of this, saying it can't be good for people to come and work for the company you founded on potentially extraordinarily dangerous technologies with no real knowledge of previous encounters between the worlds of technology and the worlds of power. And I wish we could do something about that. Having failed to really make any impact at Stanford on the pedagogical side, I've concluded that we'll have to do it somewhere else, and that place will be Austin. And so the goal is that within as short a time as possible, we start to produce people who are completely conversant with the science and technology at the highest level, at the cutting edge, but are aware that there are certain things that remain the same historically, that aren't altered by technology. That's why we can understand Thucydides. That is why we can read the plays of Shakespeare. Because certain features of the human condition don't change with technology. The nature of power, the nature of love, these things are fundamentally not that susceptible to change. And if we don't study those perennial things, if we have a cast of technocrats who are simply ignorant of history and literature, disaster will strike. Inevitably, Friedrich Meinecke wrote an extraordinary book, Die Deutsche Katastrophe, The German Catastrophe at the End of World War II. And one of the key arguments he makes in that book is that the German technocratic elite had become entirely alienated from ethical values. And this is actually one of the best explanations of the German catastrophe that there has ever been. And it has as much relevance to the United States today as Bender's essay on the treason of the intellectuals.
Wow. What a stirring note to end on. Thank you for your time, Neil.
It's been a pleasure, Annika.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians. Dr. Neil Ferguson on freedom of speech, the state of academia, and, of course, a really fascinating historical perspective. If you enjoyed this conversation, please do visit our website, jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can see all of our upcoming events for the semester, as well as recordings of all of our previous events that we host here on Princeton's campus. You can also sign up for our mailing list and learn more about our mission and what we do here at Princeton. Please also leave us a rating or review. We really, really appreciate it. And you can also follow us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. Again, thanks so much for tuning in. I'm really excited to see you next week here on Madison's Notes.